Yeah, I know. But it'll be okay. Hello, and welcome to Cromford's Assortment on Thursday, the 30th of April, 2020. April in Buxton certainly came in like a lion, and it's going out like a tadpole, I can tell you. On this day, the 30th of April, in 1789, hail to the chief, George Washington took his oath of office, becoming the first duly elected President of the United States, and the West Wing was only 210 years away. On this day in 1803, what became known as the Louisiana Purchase took place. France sold its Louisiana territory to the US for $15 million. That territory covered about 12 of the modern United States, which makes the transaction something like $18 per square mile. Now that's what you call a bargain. On this day in 1859, Charles Dickens's latest instant classic, A Tale of Two Cities, began serialisation in the weekly magazine All the Year Round. I haven't read it, but I can confirm that Truro isn't one of the cities. It isn't the other one either. On this day in 1897, physicist J.J. Thomson, in a Royal Institution lecture, announced that he had discovered the electron. The electron, you notice. I'd always thought there were more than one. And as it was so small, you wonder where he'd thought of looking. In his sock drawer, perhaps. On this day in 1966, a bard called Anton LaVey founded the Church of Satan in San Francisco. That's nowhere near as daft or creepy as it sounds, actually. Read up on it if you don't believe me. On this day in 1989, the World Wide Web was launched in the public domain by Tim Berners-Lee, who apparently wanted some way of sharing his cat videos with the whole planet. Citation needed. On this day in 1997, Big Ben's clock stopped at 11 minutes past 12 midday for 54 minutes, apparently. It got going again when John Prescott gave the tower a damn good kicking. April the 30th is International Jazz Day. So, whatever your instrument, take a freeform solo to celebrate. Go on, it doesn't matter what you play, take a solo. Set your spirit free. Push it to the brink of... You, with the stylophone. I think they need some help in the kitchen. April the 30th is also Honesty Day in the USA. So the world of modern art quakes in its overindulged, overrated boots for the day. The evening of April the 30th is also Walpurgis Night in German folklore. One of those evil spirits holding sway nights of the year. So mind your P's and Q's. Now, a few weeks ago, I played you a demo that I'd put together for the Crosby, Stills and Nash song, Guinevere, in aid of a show that we were putting together for the Buxton Fringe in 2013. So now I thought I would dust off another one and play that for you. So this is my vocal parts learning demo version of Stephen Stills's You Don't Have to Cry.
2, 1, 2, 3, 4... In the morning, when you rise, do you think of me and how you left me crying? Are you thinking of telephones and managers and where you got to be at noon? You are living a reality I left years ago. It quite nearly killed me. In the long run, it will make you cry, make you crazy and old before your time. And the difference between me and you, I won't argue right or wrong, but I have time to cry, my baby. You don't have to cry, I said, cry, my baby. You don't have to cry, I said, cry, my baby. You don't have to cry. Of me and how you left me crying. Are you thinking of telephones and managers and where you got to be at noon? You are living a reality I left years ago. It quite nearly killed me. In the long run, it will make you cry, make you crazy and old before your time. And the difference, babe, between me and you, I won't argue right or wrong, but I have time to cry, my baby. You don't have to cry, cry, my baby. You don't have to cry, cry, my baby. You don't have to cry.
This next item is a bit of fun if you like that sort of thing, and I think you should. It's an excerpt from The Goon Show, one of the episodes in 1954, called The Affair of the Lone Banana. And you have to picture a time, well, when we could still travel anywhere, and a time when steamships plied the oceans. Here we have Harry Secombe as Neddy Seagoon, attempting to book a passage to South America in a shipping office in London, run by Peter Sellers as Henry Crun.
Who is it? Who is it?
Good morning.
Thank you.
I want to book for South America.
That's abroad, isn't it?
Yes. It isn't on the tube, you know.
Isn't that wonderful? Whatever will they think of next? I don't know. Do sit down, sir.
There aren't any chairs.
You can stand up if you wish.
Thank you.
No extra charge. It's all on the house now. Let us get some details and documents. We must have the documents, you know. Just take a few particulars. Now, let's get the details and the documents. Must have the document, you know.
Of course.
Must have the document. Now, what was this all about? Oh, yes, yes. Your name?
Neddy Pugh Seagoon.
N-E-D-D-I-E. Neddy? What was next?
Neddy Pugh Seagoon.
Pugh? P-H-E-W?
No. It's pronounced Pugh, but it's spelt Pug.
Pug, yes. P-U-G-H.
Yes.
There. Neddy Pug Seagoon. Wasn't it?
Yes, Seagoon. S-E-A-G-O-O-N.
Could you spell it?
Certainly, S-E-A-G-O-O-N.
Seagoon. S-E-A.
G-O-O-N, Seagoon.
Yeah, yes. Yes, good, good. Yes, yes, yes. The full name now. Address?
No fixed abode.
No. F-I-X-E-D. Fixed. A-B.
A-B-O-D-E.
O-D-E. There we are. No fixed abode. What number?
29A.
29A.
Yes.
29K. District?
London SW2.
LONDON. South West DST. 2, wasn't it?
Yes, 2.
TW. It's no good. I'd better get a pencil and paper and write all this down.
Marvellous. I love all that stuff. I missed it the first time round, but I really got into it when I was a teenager. They were the goons that were the Monty Python of their day. They were the... Well, who has there been since then? Now it's time for my On the Trot spot, where I suggest something that you can put in your ears to go for your daily walk or your daily jog. And today I think it's either a very boundy sort of jog or a very energetic power walk, because this one's a sort of mid-tempo kind of on-the-trot jog thing. It's from 1994, it's called This Generation, and it's by Roachford.
Thank you.
Okay, now we come to what I've called 12-minute tale, because it comes in as about 11 and three-quarter minutes, you see. This is a story with a twist set in America just before the 4th of July holiday weekend. The Holiday Man by Richard Matheson.
"You'll be late," she said.
He leaned back tiredly in his chair. "I know," he answered. They were in the kitchen having breakfast. David hadn't eaten much. Mostly he'd drunk black coffee and stared at the tablecloth. There were three lines running through it that looked like intersecting highways.
"Well,"
she said. He shivered and took his eyes from the tablecloth. "Yes," he said, "all right." He kept sitting there.
"David,"
she said. I know, he said. "I'll be late." He wasn't angry. There was no anger left in him.
"You certainly will,"
she said, buttering her toast. She spread on thick raspberry jam, then bit off a piece and chewed it cracklingly. David got up and walked across the kitchen. At the door, he stopped and turned. He stared at the back of her head. "Why couldn't I?" he asked again.
"Because you can't," she said. "That's all."
"But why?"
"Because they need you," she said. "Because they pay you well, and you couldn't do anything else. Isn't it obvious?"
"They could find someone else."
"Oh, stop it," she said. "You know they couldn't."
He closed his hands into fists. "Why should I be the one?" he asked. She didn't answer. She sat eating her toast.
"Jean." "There's nothing more to say," she said, chewing.
She turned around.
"Now, will you go?" she said. "You shouldn't be late today."
David felt a chill in his flesh. "No," he said, "not today." He walked out of the kitchen and went upstairs. There, he brushed his teeth, polished his shoes, and put on a tie. Before 8, he was down again. He went into the kitchen. "Goodbye," he said. She tilted up her cheek for him and he kissed it.
"Bye, dear," she said. "Have a..."
She stopped abruptly. "Nice day," he finished for her. "Thank you." He turned away. "I'll have a lovely day." Long ago, he had stopped driving a car. Mornings, he walked to the railroad station. He didn't even like to ride with someone else or take a bus. At the station, he stood outside on the platform, waiting for the train. He had no newspaper. He never bought them anymore. He didn't like to read the papers.
"Morning, Garrett."
He turned and saw Henry Coulter, who also worked in the city. Coulter patted him on the back. "Good morning," David said.
"How's it going?"
Coulter asked. "Fine, thank you."
"Good. Looking forward to the 4th?
David swallowed. "Well," he began.
"Myself, I'm taking the family to the woods," said Coulter. "No lousy fireworks for us. Piling into the old bus and heading out till the fireworks are over."
"Driving," said David.
"Yes, sir," said Coulter. "Far as we can."
It began by itself. No, he thought, not now. He forced it back into its darkness.
"Sizing business,"
Coulter finished. "What?" he asked.
"Said I trust things are going well in the advertising business."
David cleared his throat. "Oh, yes," he said. "Fine." He always forgot about the lie he had told Coulter.
When the train arrived, he sat in the no-smoking car, knowing that Coulter always smoked a cigar en route. He didn't want to sit with Coulter. Not now. All the way to the city, he sat looking out the window. Mostly, he watched road and highway traffic, but once, while the train rattled over a bridge, he stared down at the mirror-like surface of a lake. Once, he put his head back and looked up at the sun. He was actually at the elevator when he stopped. "Up," said the man in the maroon uniform. He looked at David steadily, and then he closed the rolling doors. David stood motionless. People began to cluster around him. In a moment, he turned and shouldered by them, pushing through the revolving door. As he came out, the oven heat of July surrounded him. He moved along the sidewalk like a man asleep. On the next block, he entered a bar. Inside, it was cold and dim. There were no customers. Not even the bartender was visible. David sank down in the shadow of a booth and took his hat off. He leaned his head back and closed his eyes. He couldn't do it. He simply could not go up to his office. No matter what Jean said, no matter what anyone said. He clasped his hands on the table edge and squeezed them until the fingers were pressed dry of blood. He just wouldn't.
"Help you?" asked a voice.
David opened his eyes. The bartender was standing by the booth, looking down at him.
Yes, beer, he said.
He hated beer, but he knew he had to buy something for the privilege of sitting in the chilly silence undisturbed. He wouldn't drink it. The bartender brought the beer, and David paid for it. Then, when the bartender had gone, he began to turn the glass slowly on the tabletop. While he was doing this, it began again. With a gasp, he pushed it away.
"No!"
he told it, savagely. In a while, he got up and left the bar. It was past 10. That didn't matter, of course. They knew he was always late. They knew he always tried to break away from it, and never could. His office was at the back of the suite, a small cubicle furnished only with a rug, a sofa, and a small desk on which lay pencils and white paper. It was all he needed. Once he'd had a secretary, but he hadn't liked the idea of her sitting outside the door and listening to him scream. No one saw him enter. He let himself in from the hall through a private door. Inside, he relocked the door, then took off his suit coat and laid it across the desk. It was stuffy in the office, so he walked across and pulled up the window. Far below, the city moved. He stood watching it. How many of them, he thought. Sighing heavily, he turned. Well, he was here. There was no point in hesitating any longer. He was committed now. The best thing was to get it over and clear out. He drew the blinds, walked over to the couch, and lay down. He fussed a little with the pillow, then stretched once and was still. Almost immediately, he felt his limbs going numb. It began. He did not stop it now. It trickled on his brain like melted ice. It rushed like winter wind. It spun like blizzard vapor. It leapt and ran and billowed and exploded, and his mind was filled with it. He grew rigid and began to gasp, his chest twitching with breath, the beating of his heart a violent stagger. His hands drew in like white talons, clutching and scratching at the couch. He shivered and groaned and writhed. Finally, he screamed. He screamed for a very long while. When it was done, he lay limp and motionless on the couch, his eyes like balls of frozen glass. When he could, he raised his arm and looked at his wristwatch. It was almost 2. He struggled to his feet. His bones felt sheathed with lead, but he managed to stumble to his desk and sit before it. There, he wrote on a sheet of paper, and when he was finished, slumped across the desk and fell into exhausted sleep. Later, he woke up and took the sheet of paper to his superior, who, looking it over, nodded.
486, huh?
The superior said.
You're sure of this?
I'm sure, said David quietly. I watched every one. He didn't mention that Coulter and his family were among them.
All right, said his superior. Let's see now. 452 from traffic accidents, 18 from drowning, 7 from sunstroke, 3 from fireworks, 6 from miscellaneous causes.
Such as a little girl being burnt to death, David thought. Such as a baby boy eating ant poison. Such as a woman being electrocuted. A man dying of snake bite.
Well, let's make it, 450. It's always impressive when more people die than we predict.
Of course, David said. The item was on the front page of all the newspapers that afternoon. While David was riding home, the man in front of him turned to his neighbour and said,
What I'd like to know is, how can they tell?
David got up and went back to the platform on the end of the car. Until he got off, he stood there, listening to the train wheels and thinking about Labour Day.
And as we emerge from the Twilight Zone, that's about all I've been able to put together for you this week. I hope you've enjoyed it, and if so, please make a date for next week's programme on Thursday, the 7th of May. In the meantime, keep a grip on yourself. Be patient, stay sane, safe, and well. I made this program for you, and I'm going to be here sending them out as long as you are there to receive them. Let's get through this. Bye for now. Cromford's assortment was conceived, assembled, and presented by me, Paul Cromford. I don't own The Goon Shows, or Stephen Stills's You Don't Have to Cry, or Roachford's This Generation. I just borrowed them to entertain you. All incidental music throughout the programme. Composed, arranged, and performed by Paul Cromford. This was a Paul Cromford production. For you. Who else?